with only minor, unfair setbacks from which I cleverly recovered. How easy Michaela was to deceive, manipulate into taking me straight to the sphere I required to implement my plans. I'd enacted my ruse at length, and with elaborate conviction, in case she'd been somehow able to spy upon me. Brilliance, such as mine, takes nothing for granted. I'd permitted her to regain my body for a time, lingering, watching, spying upon Barons, studying how he handled her, protected her from certain information, filing that knowledge away to use at the proper time, waiting for precisely the right moment to reclaim control of her body. The look on Jada's face. Such fun and games there. I'd wanted to smash my fist into it, giggle with delight, but interfering underhanded Barons had attacked me unfairly, seizing me from behind while I was invisible. I dragged the unseelie princess behind me by her hair, cocooned in crimson runes. I summoned and slapped them on her without even breaking stride as I strode through Dublin. Although Michaela's body continues to weaken, I float on a cloud of radiant energy, sustained by the promise of my certain success so near at hand. I am. And I am deservedly ebullient. I drop my spell of invisibility. It's no longer necessary. And as I'm dragging the princess, my presence is obvious. I don't repeat the same intellectual lapses. I whistle a cheery tune, put a hop and skip into my passage over the crimson marble floors, and burst into song. Shaboom, shaboom, sha-la-la-la-la-la-la-la, shaboom, shaboom. Expediency is priority. I will kill the princess once I reach the boudoir, while simultaneously summoning the Seelie Queen. The fool king didn't realize how much of his own knowledge he was passing into me the day he created me. I know precisely where he once placed his palm on the wall in the concubine's chamber, to call his lover, so he need not search his domain for her. Two swift strikes with the spear. Princess, then queen. Then I'll sift out instantly to the Fey Court to drink the elixir of life, the location of which will become known to me once I acquire the true magic from the Queen. Then off to see the wizard, as Michaela would say, to snatch aside his curtain and reveal him as the charlatan he is compared to the real power I am. Then I will kill the bastard king who made and abandoned me so long ago. A giggle escapes me. It has all been so serious up until now. I've been so focused on my goals, I've not gotten to play. Haven't permitted myself the opportunity to display my most dazzling powers, as I've required things on this world expediently. But that will soon be rectified. Then, I can take my time, trot out my favorite spells. I will torture the vile, privileged, soft, Seely, before I leave this world, mutilate and mutate them, leaving them hideous, deformed, amputated bits and pieces, hobble them and turn them inside out, show them what it is to live in hell forever. Shaboom! I punctuate the arousing thought with a shout. Then I will fuck Jericho Barons to death. Over and over, amid much blood and torture, I will flay his skin from his bones while I fuck him. I will experience lust to its fullest degree in every capacity possible. Then I will sink within and torment the mouse in my house. The pathetic, fragile, morally castrated Michaela, who has already been so undone by weakness that she's withdrawn into a catatonic fetal ball inside me. And all it took to reduce her to such a state was allowing her to see herself torture and kill, get a small taste of the delights in which her body had been indulging. I should have permitted her to watch all along. I giggle and burst into another song as I skip down the corridor. Bubba baby, you ain't seen nothing yet. Here's something you're never gonna forget, baby. Such as when I force her to watch her own hand feeding starry runes to the black holes, exponentially expanding their growth, destroying her planet in a matter of mere days, instead of the months it might currently take. Wake the fuck up. There are always more worlds. I will rule all of them. I will be feared, revered, obeyed, got it made in the motherfucking shade. Fragile Michaela, so easily broken. She gets attached to things, people, places, even pieces of clothing. As if it fucking matters what she wears, where she lives, as if any of the people around her are actually real. No one is real but me. They are things, not alive. Not like I am. I'm disappointed she buckled so soon. I'd indulged myself in additional festivities en route to the White Mansion, the results of which, sadly, she didn't get to see. I'd wanted her to watch the splendid feats I'd done with her hands, but she'd been gone. So near to dead, I've begun to wonder if I'll even get the chance to torture her more. I'll revive her. She can't escape me. That's a certainty in my world. We will always be together. I will always have my sad little horse to break and repair. Break and repair. She will watch me kavrak her world and everything in it. Brilliance such as mine demands an audience. I won't be cheated of my chance to watch her do what she does best, bleed, 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 and revel in being me, not it, as it spews emotion all over the place. I won't be deprived of the opportunity to see it realize, fully understand how clever, powerful, and brilliant I am. One of those priceless, perfect moments, I gather, like luminous pearls where, in the horrified comprehension in its gaze, I know it knows it helped orchestrate its own destruction. That's the moment I crave, desire, lust for, when my toys realize they are to blame for their own fucking fate. I wonder if anyone drank my poison water at the Abbey and bled out. Ruining that I wasn't there at the moment they realized what they'd done to themselves. They didn't have to take a drink. They chose to. I am not to blame. They killed themselves. But there will be endless opportunities for such rich experiences soon. When I kick open the door to the boudoir, I draw up, surprised into a moment of near immobility. Triumph saturates my being. Again, I am vindicated by the universe. Chance favors the prepared mind. The universe adores the bold, fearless conqueror and seeks to aid him. No need to summon the queen. She's already here. I leap into the room, drag the princess in behind me, slam the door, and exclaim brightly, "Shaboom." 26. Choose, they croon, the ancient ones. The time has come again. Avil. It's mad, Avil said softly, staring through the shadowy, translucent silver at the thing that had just burst into the concubine's boudoir, shouting nonsense. Utterly and completely mad.
Oh, mad,
the Tamura agreed. She swept at the bird with her hand, urging it. Fly now, young one, go. I'll not see you harmed, too.
Ah, fly now.
It pecked at her cheek sharply, as if urging her into action. I can't, Avil said. She was trapped. Was this the fate the king intended for her? Had he decided to terminate her existence in such a cruel, ironic fashion because she'd forced him to face what he'd refused to believe for eons? That his lover had left him by choice. Go, she shooed it again. It feeds on death and destruction. I'll not give it more of what it wants. Still, the Tamura kept its talons dug deep into her cloak. Get off me! She smacked lightly at its feathery belly with her hand.
Ah!
It gave her a look of seeming reproach and lifted off, echoing in a loud squawk.
Give it what it wants!
The Tamura soared up to the safety of the starry night sky, shrieking the random selection of words over and over again. Even as peaceful Zara, she sometimes longed to muzzle her talkative companion's lovely beaks. Sealing herself, she turned to face her would-be executioner. Michaela O'Connor, the young child whom she'd so often visited in dreams, was now a grown woman, her jeans crusted with blood and entrails, her hair a wild mass of tangled clumps, the look in her eyes completely and utterly insane. Black irises had obliterated green, and, as the Fae Queen stared through the shadowy silver at her, she felt a pale regret. She'd manipulated the O'Connor, as she herself had been manipulated. As the Fae King had tinkered with the mortal Zara, so too had the Fae Queen tinkered with the mortal Mac. But regret changed nothing, pale or vivid. The Shisadu was in full possession of what had once been human, but the golden glow of the O'Connor's soul was already fading. No soul would survive long, possessed by such evil as what faced her now, with but one goal, to kill her and seize the true magic of her race. No, not her race. The race she despised. The race that would soon become extinct without the Song of Making. And good riddance to it. The book would no doubt then seek her elixir, become immortal, thus ensuring the final death of the O'Connor's soul. She would become every bit as much a monster as the one that possessed her. Avil narrowed her eyes. She felt the proximity of the others, those who sought to stop the Shisadu. She felt, too, the presence of the legendary four stones carved from the cliffs of the Unseelie prison, etched with powerful spells capable of holding the Shisadu in a state of suspended animation. The day was not yet lost. Her lips twisted in an imperious sneer. He was coming, too. The one from whom she'd begged her favor. The one who'd lied, and with the offer of a glass of wine to toast her freedom, had stolen her memory, then dragged her off to live for hundreds of thousands of years among her enemy, masquerading as ally at her side, controlling her, shaping her, taking what he wanted, until what he wanted was nothing less than everything she had, at which point he tried to kill her. Cruz was with them.
Ah?
The Temura squawked loudly from above, echoing bits of her earlier words again.
Give it what it wants.
Avil cocked her head and glanced up sharply, as the Temura's words abruptly seemed no longer quite so random. 27. Mahler's Unfinished Tenth. Cook Version. Mac.
This is how it feels to be the Shisadu. Only better. I lack even its shallow frustration and glee. There's nothing left of emotion, nor any desire for it. I'm perfection of aim, purpose without self. I'm arrow to goal without ego. I expand effortlessly into my body to evict the parasite that thinks to take from me what is mine. I apprehend the small, dark stain of it, as if from a great distance. How dare it walk within my walls? This is my kingdom.
28. Releasing the Demons. Shisadu.
I lunge for the mirror, dropping the princess, leaving her behind. Cocooned like Cruz and the Highlander, she presents no threat to me. Can't contend for the true magic. I am eager to taste my deserved victory, and will visit her and my other toys soon, with ample time to savor their suffering. I realize now that the universe was once again favoring me, not working against me as I'd thought, when it permitted Jada to take my spear. Over-eager from long incarceration, I would have rashly killed all three. Now, I can draw out their Stop. My feet skid to a halt on the black marble floor so abruptly, I nearly topple face forward. I try to lunge again but remain rooted where I am. I cock my head without resisting further, pondering the oddity of just having forced myself to stop. Do I now possess in human form the equivalent of a gut instinct, Did it sense some peril to me I failed to take into account? I assess the Fey Queen, her shadowy outline beyond the silver. I hold the spear in my hand. There is no peril to me here. I lunge forward again. Stop. My foot returns to the floor, mere paces from my goal. I'm so close I could reach out and touch the silver. The voice was mine, but it wasn't mine. Who then? Is there some other entity inside me that has been cleverly concealed from me all this time? The voice didn't belong to the sniveling Michaela. It is fetal, catatonic within me. It crumbled when I let it watch a single one of the glorious murders we've committed. It imploded beneath an onslaught of the illusions of guilt, complicity, regret. What the fuck is regret? I've never fathomed that muddy mix of emotion. It could never speak with such a voice. This was a voice of power. Who is it? What is it? Desire, purpose, and commitment to the path I choose to walk, Michaela says, in a voice just like mine. I'd be rendered immobile if I weren't already. What has it done? How has it done it? My mind whirls, dances, and skids across bits and pieces of the facts of Michaela's existence I have tirelessly gathered over the years. I know this puny creature. I know its limits, its weakness. I know what it is capable of, and not. Ah, I would narrow my eyes and smile if I were in control of our vessel, but at the moment, it holds me motionless. It has not tried to move my body, has not tried to back me away. It can't. No more than it can sustain this emotionless state of temporary power it has achieved. It's an amateur, a rank pretender, aspiring to a throne it can never hold. I giggle. I'm flattered, really. But get over yourself, Michaela. It felt dead to me because it had imitated me. It did something I'd not thought possible for one born so flawed. Shed emotion like a skin it could doff and don at will. Did Michaela study me as I studied her? No matter. I am the real thing. It is not. I do what I've done so many times before. Reach for its subconscious and feed it vivid images to manipulate and distract. Exploit that oh-so-exploitable part of it. I show it what it did to Christian, to Cruz, and wait for it to shatter. Irrelevant, is its toneless reply. Incensed, I flood it with graphic details of the moment I ripped Marjorie's still-beating heart from her breast. Distraction, it says without inflection. I feel my right foot draw up from the floor, then move backward as it dares to try to move me away from my goal, so near, so near. Behind me, the boudoir door crashes open, and I hear shouts of,
"Place the stones, quickly!"
Then Barons roars,
"Cruz, you fucking bastard, do it or die!"
Snarls fill the air, and I hear a scuffle. I'm filled with fury, apprehending Michaela's plan. It doesn't have to sustain its emotionless state forever. Just long enough to hold me motionless and permit them to contain us. It would see itself locked away with me forever simply to prevent me from achieving my rightful place in this world. How unfair. How positively petulant it is. I play my trump card. I slam graphic images into its brain, finding Jo and offering her the poisoned water, grabbing her by the shoulder, smashing its fist into her face again and again, shattering bones, exploding brain, kicking and pulping organs, sinking to the ground, eating Joe slowly and with great gusto. Yes, yes, I tell it, you are correct. That is what was in your teeth. Bits of Joe were caught between them. You ate your friend. You killed her, and I made my eyes green for her so she died believing it was you. I feel it then. The weakness I've come to know and cherish in my lovely bird in the cage. The surface of its false facade cracks, and emotion begins to seep in. It is so easy to break, so simple to control. I can never be broken in such fashion. I am superior. Before they have time to place the final two stones, I recover control of my body and leap into the silver. As we pass through the gelatinous membrane, I realize, with utter incredulity, that I am being scraped from my limbs, my eyes. The bitch has somehow taken control back. Then we're through. Mere inches from the queen, and Michaela yanks me up short, a strike of a spear away from my goal. All I require is control of my hand to kill the bitch queen and take what is mine. I stare with bottomless hunger at Aviel from behind eyes I can't influence, unable to affect so much as a finger. Again, I assault Michaela with images. This time, of the woman I impaled on a spiked fence en route to the bookstore. The young, handsome man I left with nothing between his legs, bleeding in the street. The child I stabbed through the eye with my spear, then twirled in the air as if on a skewer before tossing it into a crumpled heap. It's the last one that gets it. It falters. I seize control of my hand, raise the spear, and it freezes me again. I'm not dying for them. The queen sneers contemptuously. They're not my people. They never were. You want the power of the Fey race? Fine. Take it. Aviel slams her palms into my chest.
29. Let it go. Let it go. Turn away and slam the door. Mac.
But my eyes were green. I think dispassionately as the queen's hands slam into my chest. Didn't she notice? Or perhaps she didn't care, unwilling to take the chance I might lack the stamina to see my battle through. Ancient power rushes into me, penetrating my sternum, burrowing deep, and I feel as if my body is being filled with dense brilliance. It gushes into me in an endless flood. Too much. Too much. I can't possibly hold it. Then the queen is shoving me backward into the mirror, back to the concubine side of the boudoir as she issues an imperious command through the silver to barons. She will be immobile for several minutes while she absorbs the true magic. You must contain her, now. I tell barons it's not necessary because I'm in control, but I can't affect my vocal cords, my mouth, nor can the Shisa do. We're both in a state of suspension, immobilized by the transference of the queen's blinding, stupefying power. It feels as if 5 tons of concrete just got dumped into a quart jar. I'm not Fey. How is this even possible? Will it destroy me? Tear us apart? Is that her point, her purpose? I remain at the ready, the composed, untouchable thing I've become, to defeat the Shisa Du for good the moment the power transfer is done. Assuming we survive. The book tried its best to restore emotion to me and nearly succeeded, but failed. I'm beyond emotion now. I bear no guilt, no sins. I know neither right nor wrong. There is only aim and purity of purpose, the path I've chosen to walk. Distantly, I hear Cruz roar furiously.
Why would you give it to a human? I was here. I am the worthy successor, yet you gave it to her?
Aviel says, I know everything now, Cruz. You who were once my treasured friend. My memory is restored. You betrayed me. You promised to return me to my world and let me die.
I gave you everything. I gave you immortality.
I never wanted it, she snarls. You knew that.
But to give it to a human?
He sneers.
Can she even carry it?
This one can, Aviel says, and I hear something in her voice and realize she did notice that my eyes were green. She knew it was me, not the book, and did it anyway. Why? You took everything from me, she says to Cruz. But even that was not enough for you. In time, I might have chosen to pass my power to you as I faded. Risk a patriarchal rule. I saw your strength. Even at times, your wisdom. But you tried to steal it from me.
For the good of our kind.
Your kind, she says with an icy laugh. Not mine. And your kind is beyond hope now. The moment the Earth dies, thanks to yet another of the King's reckless acts of creation, the entire race of the Two-A-Day Dana will expire, each and every one of you. Think no longer of yourself as immortal. You have mere months, at best.
We will leave this planet.
Cruz hisses. Run as far as you want. It will do you no good. I bound the seat of our race's power to the Earth. Cruz inhales sharply, then says disbelievingly,
What the fuck were you thinking? Planets die. You know that.
She laughs mirthlessly. And now so will the Fae, the instant the Earth does. I can do nothing to arrest the velocity with which Avil shoved me into the silver. After what seemed several long moments of passing through it, I explode from the sticky membrane, go flying backward through the air, and crash violently to the floor. My head snaps back and smacks marble with such force I see stars. Then darkness claims me, and I see no more. When I regain consciousness, I'm in a chair, in the middle of the concubine's boudoir, unable to move. My eyes are open, and beyond twinkling diamonds suspended on air, I see the cocooned body of the Unseelie Princess, the thunderous-faced Cruz, being forcibly restrained by stony-eyed Fade and Lore, ashen-faced Jada, eyes enormous and full of grief, and beyond her, the residue of the concubine, reclining on her plush white bed. Barons. My beautiful Baron stands in front of me, dark gaze glittering with crimson flecks, mouth drawn back in a silent snarl. The shimmering blue-black containment field of stone connecting to stone stretches between us from floor to ceiling, vanishing around my sides where I see no more of it, but know my prison is complete. And, as I suspected, it renders both the book and me fully inert, while leaving both of us fully cognizant. That's okay. It's done. The Shisadu is contained and can no longer harm anyone.
Not true, sweet thing.
It purrs.
I have you, and an eternity to punish you for what you've done. Before I was alone beneath the abbey. Now I have a toy. And I will break free again. It's only a matter of time. And time,
it croons with guttural glee,
is on my side. Yes, it is.
It resurrects the images it fed me before, slamming them into my brain in gruesome detail. I have no idea if I did the things it shows me, if I really killed Jo so horrifically, causing her such hellish pain while she believed it was me, or if everything is merely an illusion the Shisadu feeds me. But here and now it's irrelevant. I know what it's doing. Trying to distract me while it searches for the true magic inside us, in hopes of using it to quell me and break free of our prison. But it's too late. I've already found it. Legs splayed, arms folded, I stand atop the shining vault of power the Queen passed us, blazing with purpose and power. I will never let the book touch it. It's in my kingdom. That makes it mine.
Mikaela,
it says in a sing-song voice.
I know you're in here. Ollie, Ollie, oxen free. Come out, wherever you are. Stop being so tiresome. You will never defeat me. All you did was temporarily suspend emotion. That doesn't make you my equal. You can never be my equal. I am superior in every way.
No, it's not. I may have turned off my emotion, but I can turn it back on. It has no emotion to turn on. That is its two-dimensional, flat, miserable, unsatisfying existence. I'm fully formed, missing nothing, needing nothing to leech onto. I have worlds of possibility inside me. It has none. It's empty,
so empty that it tries desperately to fill itself by stealing from others. The Shisadu is the true cardboard cutout, empty, flat and flawed, with its parasitic needs scribbled on its face for all to see. I have no needs, bitch. It is you who are flawed. It's nothing but need. Empty, greedy, black hole-sucking need. And it knows it. So it tells itself lie after lie, weaves an elaborate illusion of superiority, in hopes of escaping the horrific awareness that it is fatally, damningly flawed, missing something of the divine the rest of us have. An epiphany takes gentle root within me. The Shisadu has no hold on me. The only hold it ever had was that it managed to latch onto me when I was unaware, innocent and young, and didn't know such monsters existed. I'm no longer unaware, innocent, or young. I don't need to evict it. I can simply walk away. When I rise from the chair, those in the boudoir panic and begin to roar at one another. But not Barron's. He stands motionless, searching my eyes through the crackling blue-black wall, and slowly, very slowly, the corner of his mouth ticks up in a smile. I smile back as I move toward the perimeter of the prison that can't contain me, wasn't designed to do so, because I'm not the Shisadu. I never was. I have an unfortunate hitchhiker. It's time to kick it out of the car. As I step into the containment field, the Shisadu screams, "Don't you dare leave me! Don't you know you can't exist without me? I love you, Michaela. I'm the only one that loves you. I'm not done with you. I will kill you. Get back here. I will destroy." I'm beyond the containment field of the stones. I'm free. I can no longer hear the Shisadu's threats and taunts. And never will again.
30. Lingering in the ether, the Unseelie King retrieved the small scroll tied with a lock of his lover's hair from where he carried it near his heart. He rolled the tiny thing in his enormous palm. He knew now. She'd left him by choice. He'd suspected the elixir of remembering had only a nominal chance of success. He'd created it when he realized he was losing memories to the relentless march of time. He'd wanted to keep each moment of his existence alive, vivid in detail, visceral and immediate. Imbibed on a daily basis, the elixir conferred the result he'd desired. But as he'd feared, drinking it hundreds of thousands of years after the cauldron of forgetting had done its damage, restored only the details, none of the context or associated feelings. She was Zara, yet possessed none of the spectacular passion and fire that had so ensorcelled him. As icy as the first queen had ever been, she wanted nothing more from him than her freedom. He'd been a fool to believe he'd been given a second chance. Dropping the scroll, he ground it to dust beneath his heel, then vanished, seeking solitude where old gods do, among the stars.
31. Till the Love Runs Out. Mac. You know those movies where lovers have been separated with no idea whether they'll ever see each other again? And when they finally do, after harrowing trials and tribulations, they dash madly toward one another, and the filmmaker shoots the scene in slow motion so the viewers get to revel in that long, drawn-out moment of anticipation, waiting breathlessly for their first passionate embrace? That's so not what happened with me and Barron's. Neither of us moved. We just stood there looking at each other. His dark eyes gleamed with, I had no idea what, because I couldn't currently feel and had no way of identifying emotion, but I chose to believe it was satisfaction, respect, and a bloody good job, Ms. Lane. No one else in the boudoir moved either. They were all staring past me. I turned and glanced back at the containment field.
Inside a blue-black cage, a dark, angry tornado twisted and darted, flinging itself repeatedly at the walls. To no avail. I'd walked away from it. I'd left the Shisadu behind, trapped forever in its own private hell. I was unsatisfied with the outcome. I would only be satisfied when it was destroyed.
You did it, Mac!
Jada exploded fiercely, punching the air. I had indeed, but I was still remote and emotionless, and although a part of me almost yearned to stay that way, a bigger part didn't. I wanted to feel again, to drink in the moment, the dawning of a new day. I wanted to savor my hard-won freedom. There was so much future ahead of us, if we could manage to save our world. I calculated the odds at slightly better than they had been. I could feel the unfamiliar presence of the true magic smoldering inside me. And while part of me thought, gee, great, now I have another uninvited thing inside me I have to deal with, most of me was thinking how extraordinary it was that by an unexpected twist of fate, I'd become the one woman who could wield the Song of Making. That was a serious plus in our column. Cruz possessed at least some part of the Shisadu. Dagus was alive, with the souls of 13 ancient Draegar inside him. We had Dannys and Dancers' quirky, brilliant minds, and Barons' and Ryden's' vast experience with magic and the black arts. Yes, our odds were definitely better than they had been, with the Fae Queen missing and me possessed. I slanted my eyes half-closed, sank within, and embraced all that made me human. The good, the bad, the pretty, and not so pretty. And as emotion rekindled, I stared past the Shisadu's prison, through the shadows of the king's ancient, towering silver, to the woman who stood on the other side of it, a dazzling bird perched on a shoulder. She met my gaze, and I thought I detected the faintest trace of sorrow in her lovely iridescent eyes. I could recognize emotion again. Then she turned and glided to the now open door on the king's side of the boudoir, and exited through it without a word, vanishing into the White Mansion. The door swung shut behind her with such force that the floor shuddered, and the king's enormous mirror abruptly went coal black. The mirror shivered violently then, gilt frame and all, simply popped out of existence, leaving a smooth, white wall where once it had hung. The concubine's boudoir no longer connected to the king's. The tiny flames flickering and the diamonds floating on the air around us abruptly went out, leaving cold, opaque crystals that clattered to the floor, amid petals that no longer smelled spicy, but now emitted a strong whiff of decay. The residue of the concubine vanished from the bed. The fire in the hearth died. The chamber was just a chamber, void of all trace of the opulent beauty, passion, and sensuality that had saturated it. Although I had no idea what had transpired between the legendary lovers, I knew what these events signified. The epic love affair between the Unseelie King and his concubine was over. Inexpressible sorrow filled me. I felt as if I'd lost something. I'd liked believing in their immortal love. I'd once lived their passion in these rooms. And the depth of their commitment to each other had been as powerful and seemingly eternal as the Unseelie King himself. Their tortured affair had been wild and romantic, inspiring me, filling me with wonder and no small measure of desire for a similar enduring love, minus the tortured part. I frowned, not liking the implications of what I'd just seen. The Unseelie King had shut the door and turned out the light. The lights he'd kept burning for hundreds of thousands of years. If the king no longer cared for the boudoir to exist as perpetual testament to his life's love and obsession, then the king no longer cared. And his interest in human problems had always been fleetingly whimsical at best. The concubine-slash-fae queen, who might have helped me learn to use the powers she'd transferred to me, had just stalked out and slammed the door behind her. I didn't need a genius IQ to figure out what their departures meant. No divine aid to humankind would be forthcoming. Our world was dying. Months at best, the concubine had said. and we were on our own.
32. If I could save time in a bottle.
Mac. The others began to bicker. Cruz started it, no surprise there. Jada was merely proposing we take further measures to secure the Shisadu in the chamber when he launched into a haughty diatribe about how no one was going anywhere until Michaela got a human ass over here, put her hands on his chest, and passed the true magic of the Fae race to the rightful heir, the only Fae in the room, thereby entitled, no, owed, blah, blah, blah. Laura pointed out that there was a second Fae in the room, the cocooned, unseelie princess, and as far as he was concerned, if the true magic was going anywhere, and it wasn't as matriarchal power, it would clearly go to her. Barons snarled that I was never going to be getting my human ass anywhere near Cruz, not now, not ever, and then Fade jumped in, pointing out that whether or not I was still human was open to significant debate. Jada and I looked at each other in disbelief.
Shut up, all of you, I thundered.
The silence was instantaneous. Four pairs of eyes jerked my way. Even Jada looked mildly startled, and I realized my voice had come out larger than it used to, with an unmistakable note of authority.
Time moves differently while we're in here, I reminded them. The concubine said we had mere months at best before the black holes devoured our world. How long have we been in here?
Fuck!
Barons exploded, his gaze darting instantly between the imprisoned Shisadu and the door.
We can't just leave it like this. If someone finds their way in and moves a single stone, it'll be free again.
I could see that happening all too easily. People were insatiably curious. Fae were insatiably power-hungry, prone to overestimating their abilities to handle it. More than a few would be tempted to see if they could control the Shisadu. Cruz and Darok had both tried. Hell, I'd been tempted when I thought I'd killed Barons.
And who knows what it's capable of in that form? Jada said. It might be like that movie, Fallen, with Denzel Washington, where Azazel could jump from body to body. Mac may have inadvertently left it in a form that makes it even easier for it to possess people.
And thank you for pointing that out, I said caustically, irritated with myself. I wanted the thing gone, dead, destroyed, dust. Not existing in an even more dangerous form that might be able to whiz through the air, entering and exiting humans as if they were convenient revolving doors, possessing hundreds, even thousands if it escaped. To Barons, I said, can you ward the door?
For fuck's sake, it's not a mere twinkle of a nose. Wards take time.
To Cruz, I said, what can you do quickly to fortify this chamber? He folded his arms over his chest and regarded me with open hostility.
You are the one who is so all-powerful now. You do something, or transfer the power to me and I will.
A muscle leapt in my jaw. Did you somehow miss the point of what the concubine said? If our planet dies, your race dies too. Secure the damn door, Cruz, I said flatly. Baron stalked out and we followed him. Jaw clenched, Cruz joined us, closed the door, and murmured softly. An enormous steel gate appeared, barring entry, heavily bolted into the walls on sides and top, and sunk deep into the floor. But a Fae could get past that. Couldn't it? I said.
Fae are not its, Michaela. We are he's and she's,
he said tightly.
And technically, you are one of us now.
But he palmed a faintly pulsing blue-black rune and embedded it in the center bar of the gate.
This will do, for the time being.
Guys, we forgot the princess, Jada said.
She's bound in the cocoon, now doubly trapped.
Barons replied grimly.
Every minute counts, multiplied exponentially in this bloody place. Run!
We ran. Part 2. Swift as the wind, quiet as the forest, conquer like the fire, steady as a mountain. Sun Tzu. 33. Saints and sinners are but we, twisted wrecks of symmetry. Mac. We returned to a completely different New Dublin, one run with near militant efficiency by Riordan. Our stay in the White Mansion had cost us 35 days Earth time. When Riordan returned from wherever he was reborn, he discovered the six of us, Barons, Jada, Fade, Lore, Cruz and I, had been missing for a week. With no idea what had happened to us or where we'd gone, he turned his attention to our pressing problem, the black holes that continued to expand slowly but relentlessly, growing inexorably nearer to the ground. No one had any idea what would happen if one of the black holes made contact with the soil. We didn't fully understand the physics of the black holes we'd discovered in space, and no one knew if ours were even the same kind of thing. Dancer was convinced they were a total wild card, differing widely from naturally occurring black holes. Some people theorized it would eat slowly away at the soil. Some contended it would instantly devour a large area, while others insisted the entire Earth would be destroyed at a fairly rapid pace until it formed an accretion disk around the black hole, allowing the hole to consume it at its leisure. Since the Fae Queen had a profound connection to the Fae power nestled deep in the Earth, I was certain her estimate of mere months was correct. And considering we'd been gone more than a month of those mere months, I was grateful Riordan had thrown himself into the issue of the black holes with the same intense focus he turned on everything. In our absence, he'd befriended Dancer, or rather, commandeered the young genius to report to him daily about the progress being made at Trinity College, where a crew of 30 of the finest minds Dancer and Kiva had been able to gather struggled with theoretical physics and music theory in an effort to fathom our problem and define the essence of the Song of Making. "Riordan's been spending hours a day with them," said Enyo, the tough, young, French-Lebanese she-seer who'd stepped up to the plate at the Abbey in Jada's absence. She banged in the door of the bookstore about 1 minute after Jada and I arrived, as I'd been on my way upstairs to peel off my jeans and change into something sans guts, blood, and gray matter. Sighing, I'd gone right back down, and now sat in the middle of the wrecked bookstore, listening as Enyo brought us up to date. "Absorbing their theories, posing challenging questions, pushing their minds even further outside the box. Dancer's opinion of Riordan has certainly changed." Riordan had also turned the focus of his meticulous gaze, Enyo told us, to the other side of the city, dispatching men to the Abbey where they labored day and night displacing rubble in hopes of uncovering and salvaging as much of the Abbey's libraries as possible. The She-Seer searched whatever tomes were found, seeking useful Fey lore. He dispatched RVs and tour buses to the heavily damaged fortress to afford temporary living quarters. He'd also done the unthinkable. Chester's was closed for business. The sleek, modern chrome and glass-walled dance floors of the biggest post-war nightclub in Dublin had gone as dark as the King's boudoir. Nobody was partying on his watch, when the Earth was in imminent danger of extinction. The streets of New Dublin were patrolled day and night by dozens of troops of the Guardians, an order that had grown enormously in our absence, attracting men and women from all over the world as the influx of immigrants to the city continued unabated. Enyo informed us they were under new leadership, as Inspector Jane had mysteriously disappeared and was presumed dead. I received the news of the good inspector's death with sorrow. I'd liked Jane. He'd towed a hard line from day one, but it had been a necessary line, guided by a good heart. I glanced at Jada to see how she was taking the news. She locked gazes with me and shook her head minutely. "Tell you later," she mouthed when Enyo wasn't looking. Each and every black hole on Riordan's map, Enyo told us, had been secured, not merely by orange ropes cordoning them off, but heavily armed guards in our country as well as those in England, Scotland, Germany, France, Spain, Poland, Romania, Greece, Morocco, and Norway. Fortunately, there weren't nearly as many in other countries as there were in Ireland. I was amused to hear Riordan had begun publishing a daily paper, Riordan's World News, a fact that chafed Jada enormously. When Enyo handed her Raiden's paper, she was even more rankled to find it well-written and informative. "People rush out to get it every morning," Enyo told her. "They pass it around like the latest YouTube video gone viral." Jada's scowl deepened, and I knew what she was thinking. The Danny Daily had been mid-list at best, but Raiden's paper was a number one bestseller. She was only mildly mollified when I pointed out that becoming well-known in the media was probably Raiden's worst nightmare, without going into detail in front of Enyo about the whys. Immortals survived eternity by hiding themselves, staying well out of the media. Yet Raiden had known that the world needed a strong, well-spoken leader to follow in times of pending catastrophe, and decided he was the only one that fit the bill. Yep, king again. I wondered how many other centuries and countries he'd taken over in times of crisis, and if he understood how lucky he was that cyberspace was currently down. Like every other nine-day wonder, once we saved our world, he might be able to melt quietly into the background without having to tolerate a Facebook fan page devoted to him, where people eagerly posted reports and photos of the latest riot and sighting. I couldn't think of much else that would piss him off more. Well, I could think of a few things. According to Enyo, Raiden had mysteriously leveraged the leaders of the black market to provide free food and supplies to all the guardians and armed guards throughout multiple countries, as well as taken over We Care's meeting houses, turning them into free soup kitchens, feeding anyone who came in hungry, turning no one away.
"He did not," Jada snapped, sitting up straighter. "Sorry, Enyo. I was willing to go along with you right up until that one. Raiden doesn't give a bloody damn about the fate of the human race, and he would never divert his resources to feeding them."
"It sure looks like he cares to me," Enyo said hotly. "I've seen him out there in action. Personally, keeping tabs on every inch of this city and all its operations. I'm beginning to think the man never sleeps." I could assure Jada he didn't, but I wasn't about to. She screwed up her face in a look of such utter disgust that for a moment all I could see was young Danny again, and I had to bite my lip to keep from smiling.
"Why don't you just bloody saint the man then?" she growled. "Raiden this, Raiden that, Raiden's world news, my ass. Doesn't he know you need a catchy title? A little alliteration, a lilt to roll along the lips?"
"Either that or just the latest news," I said without thinking, then absorbed the look on Jada's face and added hastily,
"Not that yours wasn't. It was. I loved your papers. They were endlessly entertaining and informative. The Danny Daily rocked, and that one Jada Journal I saw." "Oh, stow it, Mac," she snapped. "His idiotic paper is..."
She glanced down at it irritably, where it lay smoothed out on a lap.
"Good," she allowed tightly. "He reports the news in a calm, objective manner that instills confidence that someone knows what's going on and inspires hope. He has his finger on world events, not just what's happening in Dublin like I did, and his friggin' bullet points at the end of it, with lists of things for people to do each day. Focuses them on tasks that keep them too busy to panic."
She sighed and muttered, "Fuck her." That was it. I laughed. It felt like forever since I'd seen her looking like a disgruntled porcupine. Her passion and temper were rising to the surface again. I agreed. His bulleted lists were a terrific idea, as was posting the paper early each morning before people woke up. No one greeted the day at a loss for what to do, which meant fewer people sitting around bitching, working themselves into a panic, spreading the mood. Then the next thing you knew, you had a riot forming. He kept them pointed at tasks, moving from one to-do to the next. And as I'd learned myself a little over a year ago, lists were a damned effective way to manage messy emotions. After a moment, Enyo continued, and I narrowed my eyes as I listened, beginning to wonder if this tough, battle-hardened she-seer might not just have a bit of a crush on Raiden. I glanced at Jada, and knew by her expression that she was wondering the same thing. Raiden had divided the city into numbered districts, Enyo told us, with admiration blazing in her eyes. And each district's paper had a different bulleted list at the end containing tasks specific to that small enclave of people.
Once they arrived on the job, they were assigned to teams, where they began the day with a discussion of what they were going to accomplish and how it served their long-term goals and needs, were fed 3 squares while on the job, and finished the day with an inspiring wrap-up talk. Each site was run by a foreman who'd been hand-selected by Riordan for his motivational and leadership skills.
Okay, Jada said acidly, kicking her legs over the back of the shattered Chesterfield she'd been perching on,
and stalking over the paint-stained floor to the door.
That's all the rah-rah Riordan crap I can take in one sitting. I need to get out there and see what's going on with my own eyes.
I was surprised she was just leaving without waiting for Enyo to take off so she could say,
"Wow, Mac, you're the Sealy Queen now. What's up with that?"
or something similar. But no one had seemed to want to stick around once we returned to Dublin. Cruz had instantly sifted out without a word. Barons had tersely asked me to please go to the bookstore and wait there until I get back, and yes, I did just say please, and no, not because you're the bloody queen of the fairy, but because I want you to do it and not argue, before stalking off with Lore and Fade to find Riordan. I'd tossed a mild, okay, at his back, deciding he needed a breather. Finally being free of the evil clutches of the Shisadu was breather enough for me. I was ready to get invested in the next thing and forget about the last until I went back to destroy the book for good. As Jada banged out the door, I remembered my little bell was broken and made a mental note to procure a new one, assuming I still had a door to attach it to, a building to hang said door on, and a planet for my bookstore to exist upon in a few months. I tuned back into the conversation Enyo was still carrying on, despite Jada leaving and my obvious distraction, just in time to hear her say, "So, all in all, we lost 234 of our women the night of the battle, and another 17 the morning after. But in recent weeks we've gained nearly twice those numbers from the influx into Dublin," she added with satisfaction. "Word's gotten around that this is the place for she-seers that are hungry to kick some fey ass." I sat up straighter, kicking my feet over the side of the broken chair I dragged from a pile of debris I'd not yet had time to remove from the store. "Another 17 the morning after," she'd said, which for me had been earlier today. The image the book had fed me of Joe dying had taken place in the morning. I wet, suddenly dry lips. "Do I know any of the she-seers that were killed? Not that I know many on a first-name basis, but there's Kat and Kara, Shauna and Marjorie, and who else? Let's see. Josie and Joe." I trailed off, looking at her expectantly. Enyo said, "We thought we'd lost Kat, but she turned up again just a few days ago, not saying a word to any of us about where she'd been, but acting and looking totally different." She narrowed her eyes. "I, for one, would really like to know where the hell that woman was, because I'd bet my eye teeth she somehow managed to convince Riordan, or one of his men, to train her. She wasn't nearly so cool and strong before she disappeared." Envy flashed across her beautiful, golden-skinned features. "Don't know what those men are, but I'd sure like to. And I'd like to get my own stint of training in with one of them." "And the other she-seers?" I gently nudged her back to the topic. "Shauna's alive, out at Yebby. Kara's dead, as are Marjorie and Josie. But the death I most want to avenge is Joe's." My vocal cords were abruptly strung so tight they squeaked like an out-of-tune violin when I opened my mouth and tried to speak. I had to take several slow, deep breaths before I managed to get out a quiet, "What happened to her?" Enyo's nostrils flared, her gaze turning murderous. "None of us know for sure, but I can tell you this much. It was a bad death." She locked eyes with me and said with sudden savage intensity, "I think about that, you know, in this world, the way things are. You're a fool if you don't. What's a good death, what's a bad one, and how you want to go when it's your time? When it's my time, I want to be doing something that matters. Betters the world and saves people's lives. I want my death to mean something."
She lapsed into silence, staring off into space, scowling for a long moment, then said in a low, fierce voice, "Joe's death didn't mean a damned thing."